Welcome back to another episode of the R Squared Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Levy. In this episode, our guest is Seth Partnow. Seth is the assistant editor at Nylon Calculus. He also writes for the Washington Post's Fancy Stats blog, B-Ball Breakdown, and several other sites. In this episode, we talk about some of the challenges in measuring individual defense, Golden State Warriors, and some of Seth's work with the Public Sport View data this year. All right, how you doing, Seth? Welcome back.
Yeah, good to be back.
I was just scrolling through the files as I was getting set up here, and it's been since November. Obviously, we talk a lot more regularly than that, but it's been since November since you were on the podcast.
Well, the behind the scenes machinations are endless.
a lot to talk about. A lot's happened since the last time we had you on the podcast, but. I wanted to start, we're recording this right as the Wisconsin-Duke game got started, and so I wanted to throw something at you that's maybe only sort of tangentially about analytics, but I was watching the Wisconsin-Arizona game last weekend and thinking about the characterization of Arizona as a talented team and the characterization of Wisconsin as a skilled team, and so I'm wondering about your thoughts, and I guess maybe the same is true for Duke as a talented team. And so I'm wondering your thoughts about, like, a mental Venn diagram of talent and skill, and where do they overlap, and do they overlap completely, or are they entirely separate, or...
I mean, to some degree, it's kind of definitional splitting hairs. I think kind of where people get into trouble is whether you call it talent or athleticism or raw skill or anything like that. The kind of the physical ability and it gets too often divorced from kind of the decision making process. The level of physical however you want to measure it in terms of like acceleration, leaping ability, whatever is so close that the thing that differentiates people at the elite level is the correctness and quickness of the decision making. And it's not just decision making in terms of that pass, this pass. Decision making, I pump fake, jab step, one dribble left. Those are all decisions, and the people who make those better more often are the better players. I mean, you know, I think anytime this sort of debate comes up, the classic example is like a Paul Pierce. They talk about him having that old man game, but that's what it is. It's you know, all right, if I get my defender to take one half step backwards, then when I pump fake, he's coming towards me, and then he's going to land on me and foul me. And that's skill, but it's decision making also. And that's when we talk about someone being good at basketball, that's inherently part of it.
It's funny to me because when I think about it, they're both sort of like loaded terms, and especially in the context of like Wisconsin and everything, you know, and everybody else that they've beaten in this tournament, you know, I think the sort of the implication is that like talent is a physical thing and skill is sort of like a mental thing. And then maybe with the added context of like talent is something you have and skill is something you like learn or acquire. Does that sound like a fair representation?
And I think both are incorrect too, because I mean you see it all the time that players remake kind of their physical, to some degree, remake their physical abilities. Like once they reach the pros, they better shape, stronger. If you've listened to anything that Kyle Korver has said about this year, one of his the secrets to his success has been just conditioning and improving kind of those physical traits, and whether guys get in better shape, guys get stronger, or Kevin Love loses weight so he can be a little quicker, have more stamina. Whether or not in the context of his current situation in Cleveland, he might be better off with some of the added bulk is another question. But still, those physical abilities aren't immutable, and they change over time as well. And just as one's shooting ability can improve, and one's decision making ability, and the pick and roll or defensive rotations. So. treating either of them as kind of a static attribute is I think wrong.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really interesting to me about the two is, and the overlap is, I think about like I was sort of saying, not that that's necessarily accurate, that talent right. is physical and that skill is mental, but I think that's maybe sort of the entry level perception, or like the easy way to think about them, is that there are things that are fine motor skill, which are like, I think about Steve Nash, and so much of his ability was like, obviously he was a great mental player and he could see things, but he had physical abilities that were fine motor. So not fast, or, you know, not blazing speed, not jumping out of the gym, but, you know, the ability to, you know, make a behind the back pass exactly on target with his offhand is a physical, you know, is a physical ability. But because it's sort of fine motor, it gets categorized as skill as opposed to talent.
And there's a certain sort of, you know, again, we get focused so much on kind of the raw explosive movements, you know, the first step and the jumping and stuff like that, where someone maybe more subtle skills like his kind of, this kind of leads into something about Kevin Love also, but kind of his sort of just mobility, like, you know, he kind of can make a 270-degree turn, if that makes sense, on like a dime. And that's like, that's an unusual to be able, you know, to be running one way and kind of be going, then turn and go diagonally backwards the other way while controlling the ball. That's like a rare skill. And that's an athletically marvelous thing that allows him to, you know, find that extra pocket of space, that extra little bit of time to, you know, or the to create the angle to make those plays.
Mm-hmm.
And, to relate it to, you know, Kevin Love, part of the reason why he maybe has struggled this year fitting in with Cleveland is, you know, that those kind of like subtle little, you know, slide pivot, roll kind of stuff is whether it's a function of, you know, his back not being great all year or whatever, is he just doesn't quite have that kind of that mobility, that kind of, you know, the, you know, moving from the, you know, the Nintendo four direction controller to like the PlayStation, like omnidirectional thing, you know, is like he can go up, down, left or right just fine. But if you want him to go like back into the left, it doesn't quite work as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different and finer thing, but that's also athleticism.
And so do you think like in Love's case, do you think that's a product of maybe injury or getting used to his teammates and his spots and new sort of responsibilities? Or is that something where he didn't have to respond in the same way when he was in Minnesota? And that he, you know, everybody, there's sort of a tendency to hyper focus on a single skill and be like, oh, well, he'll be great with LeBron because he shoots three pointers, and, you know, and so, you know, he can catch the ball at the elbow and make the next pass, and so naturally he will be, you know, an incredible pick and roll compliment for LeBron, but that there are some, you know, that there are some other components and there's some other sort of some physical pieces of that he didn't have to do.
Yeah, I think, and you know, breaking that down between, you know, whether what's, you know, just this year with, you know, the speculation is the back issues, which, you know, seems to be, you know, borne out by him missing games, and it's been kind of reported on and off all year.
Mm-hmm.
That's some of it, and some of it is, you know, he might just not be the most agile guy. It's, you know, if you ever spend any time like watching the mindless spectacle that is the NFL draft combine, they, you know, they talk for hours about guys who have good feet,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, the ability to make a move in one step instead of three. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, and not being specific to Kevin Love, but that's a, you know, especially for big guys who might not have like the straight line speed, the ability to do that, to, you know, make that one step shuffle instead of having to open your hips and turn and stuff like that, mm-hmm. it's a big deal.
Yeah. It may be a nice segue here into the sport view stuff, because, you know, as we get closer and closer to being able to track players' movements, maybe that's something that eventually we're sort of able to see, you know, big men moving multi-directionally, step counts and things like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that level of detail with the level of technology they currently have is maybe totally possible, but that's certainly, you know, a way to maybe more directly automate some of that stuff, which is, you know, still kind of eye test. I mean, mm-hmm. it's still very much like an eye test in terms of, you know, how smooth someone moves. I mean, that mm-hmm. was a big selling point for Joel Embiid last draft season was just how kind of smooth his gait was and how, you know, and how like the things we're talking about, the mm-hmm. kind of the naturalness of his pivot and stuff like that was a big selling factor, and, mm-hmm. and you know, whether or not the, you know, foot issues and all that will get in the way. But those are the kinds of things that, you know, is an indicator of a different kind of athleticism that is, you know, important and valuable.
Mm-hmm. I remember one of my favorite things that Henry Abbott wrote a couple years ago was about, it was about LeBron and Wade. So I guess it was the first year they were together in Miami. And, Henry had obviously just finished the book Born to Run, and I had read it about the same time too. But the book Born to Run, I won't be able to summarize it all, but it's sort of about this tribe of Native Americans who run barefoot, and they sort of have this totally different running stride, and it allows them to run barefoot, and they sort of don't have these chronic stress injuries that our runners have who run in these high-tech, you know, running shoes and all this stuff. And so he was looking at Dwayne Wade's stride versus LeBron's stride and talking about how LeBron always runs on his toes and Wade's stride sort of has this really hard heel strike. And so there was sort of this added stress component into Wade's stride, which was not there for LeBron. And then at that point, you know, Wade had sort of had this growing history of lower leg injuries. But it was such an interesting way to think about. Just a movement can sort of impact what a player's doing.
You're kind of I had Robbie Calland on my podcast over the weekend, and you're kind of daring me to open the Paul George can of worms, mm-hmm. and that's basically why I think bringing him back at the end of the season is a bad idea. Is just that I don't think he's gonna break his leg again, mm-hmm. but a guy who hasn't gone through training camp and maybe he just runs just a little bit differently, mm-hmm. and that screws an ankle up or a calf or a hip or something like that, and mm-hmm. then he's got that lingering into the off season, and then he, you know, builds strength on top of that dysfunction, and then so he comes in next year where he's stronger, but he's stronger on top of like a, you know, a nerve thing in his hip, and then where are you? And mm-hmm. so that's off Paul George soapbox, and I'm sorry because I know it hurts you actually, what are your thoughts on I know as a Pacers fan, I know uh-huh. you're happy to see him back, but just in terms of the long-term wisdom of it,
It's hard because, like, I mean, ultimately, you as a fan, you're just sort of taking it on blind faith that the training staff is considering all of these possible implications and is making the wisest choice. And, you know, I don't think the Pacers... I don't think the training staffs, when it comes to training staffs, there's sort of, you know, like the Phoenix Suns, and you know, a few terrible ones who I won't name, who sort of have horrible reputations for managing injuries. And then everybody else is just sort of a blob in the middle. And so, you know, the Pacers don't have a reputation, good or bad. You're just sort of taking it on faith that everything's been looked at and everything's been considered and that it's okay for him to play. Emotionally, it's great to see him out there on the court. Functionally, I guess it's splitting hairs, but it seems like a chance to move up in the lottery is more valuable than making the playoffs. You know, it's not like there's a ton of youth on the Pacers roster who are going to sort of gain valuable experience. the roster is probably going to look really different next year anyway. So it's not like there's sort of a bonus of continuity. So yeah, I'd just as soon that they you know, just miss out and maybe get a chance to move up.
Sure. Yeah. And that's, you know, the other half of, you know, I don't think that there's like a huge risk, but any risk measured against what, you know, as you're describing it as a very questionable upside.
Mm-hmm.
Why take the chance for no gain is almost anyway, sorry, didn't mean to derail.
But no.
You know, we're talking about, like, you know, kinesiology and stuff like that, and it's just so, anyway.
Well outside my area of expertise.
You know, mine too, but, you know, we're all doctors here, so.
So given that it's been since November since you've been on, through a full season, a lot of interesting work that you've done at Nylon Calculus, and a lot of it has been done with a second season of SportView data available, and you've been able to play with some things. So I wonder if you can talk about some of the fun stuff that you've sort of dug out of the SportView data this year, some of the interesting work you've done.
Some of the more interesting stuff is, I think, just looking at how much luck is involved in kind of shooting and or defense.
Mm-hmm.
And not making or missing a shot is obviously a bit of skill, and everyone kind of has not a true shooting percentage, but a true shooting percentage on every given shot.
Mm-hmm.
But around that, there's going to be, you know, given that there's a, you know, pretty limited sample size across an NBA season, there's going to be some noise around that. Mm-hmm. But, it's the adage that it's a make or miss league, and mm-hmm. you can get the best shots in the world and they might not go in, or you can end up jacking contested 20 footers and you might make four in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Of them. But just seeing how, even across a full season, how much, you know, noise there is and stuff like that, and how kind of much of our of kind of the narrative view of teams playing well or poorly is based on kind of almost those coin flip things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly early in the year when Cleveland had some you know questionable losses, I remember there were at least three games where they lost to decent but not great teams, comfortably but not getting blown out. And those were games where, you know, John Wall is shooting like 6 of 8 on mid-range pull-ups, or Lou Williams is hitting threes with, you know, guys draped all over him or stuff like that. And it's just like, well, you know, they're probably unlucky to lose all three of those games, because they're playing, you know, the shots that beat them were contested shots that happened to go in,
mm-hmm.
and they happened to miss open shots, and, you know, okay, there are things they could still have been doing better, but at the same time, the everybody panic was maybe a little overblown, because, you know, the guys were just, you know, using all their turbo against them, basically.
So given that that we've sort of been able to see maybe a little bit clearer the size of the impact of luck or randomness or whatever, do you feel like that lends itself to emphasizing, like, offense or defense? Like, I'm thinking about specifically that shot making, and if so much of shot making is random, does that increase the value of sort of like a marginal advantage like shot selection and being really strict with your shot selection like the Rockets do? Or does that maybe lead a team towards throwing more effort onto the defensive side and setting things up a certain way?
I don't think that we're much closer to being able to answer that mm-hmm. yet. Part of it is, you know, by the numbers, we still don't know so much about defense yet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's still, you know, there's all kinds of new numbers coming out. Not many of them are necessarily, you know, very accurate in the stated purpose, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, they are accurate in what they are claiming to measure, more or less. but the interpretation on what they're measuring is, you know, stuff like the field goal percentage as closest defender is just is so noisy that it's I would say, you know, borderline meaningless as a as an evaluative stat at this point. Well, just because there's so much else going on.
Well, I was just going to say, I know that was something that we, like when we came back from the Sloan Conference, there was the paper there, Kirk Goldsberry's team, and they had this this algorithm which used the raw sport view data to assign defensive responsibility. And I know you had a lot of questions going in, and then at the end of the presentation, somebody asked a question about like a place where there were where there had been defensive rotations and there was maybe one big man on the back line and two open offensive players close to him, and he was, and so the question was, who does your algorithm define responsibility for in that case, where there's sort of two open players that the defender should have responsibility for? And the presenter said, well, you know, our algorithm is actually more detailed than we maybe laid out in the paper, and we actually split defensive responsibility. So he's actually calculated as having responsibility for both of those offensive players, sort of apportioned by different things. And I know you had said for you that was like, well, that's the ideal, you know. No, it's not a one-on-one defense. Is not a one-on-one scenario, or not a series of one-on-one scenarios.
Not at all. It's it's you know, even the construct of offense as one player using a possession is problematic, but closer to correct than I think than the idea of one defender guarding that one player, because you're you know, not only do you have you're building in kind of the inexactness of defining the offensive possession as just that one player. Now you're completely ignoring everything else that happened before that player got the ball, as well as where kind of the other four defenders are on the court and what they're doing, and you know, all sorts of other factors that make a difference in kind to, you know, what the defensive situation would be. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that we're, this is interesting actually, cause I've spoken to, you know, people with who, people I would consider genuine experts on the subject and, have gotten 100% opposite answers in terms of how close we are to being able to, you know, on one hand, it's a matter of you know, computing power and analyst time. And the other answer is that we're nowhere close to even having a kind of a theoretical model of it. And I've gotten both answers from people who, I would consider genuine experts and knowledgeable on the subject. So I tend to be much more in the camp of, we're not really super close, even from a theoretical standpoint of, you know, maybe we'll come up with a team level way to analyze defense, but then going from there to individual, you know, point values to players is hugely problematic. And you know, I think we various kind of one number metrics have had that problem on the offensive end, or kind of the box score level of of what you know are good indicators of team winning value. Apportioning those credits to individual players leads to some unfortunate results and arguments.
So I have an interesting question that just occurred to me as we were talking. And I hope this is not a monkey wrench, but given that you have an expressed, I don't know if aversion is too strong a word, but you have some concerns about one number metrics and how they estimate player value, and some of it is about how they're presented. But given that it seems like your perspective is that ultimately defense is a team construct, and that the problem is we're trying to measure it at an individual level and we sort of don't know how to disentangle them. Is it possible that where is it possible that where maybe a bottom-up and a top-down approach on offense both have merit, that maybe on the defensive side, that maybe these top-down all-in-one sort of plus-minus metrics, because they're sort of starting with a team construct, that maybe that's a more appropriate way to measure defense, given that we don't have any sort of reliable, granular, individual defensive statistics?
I mean, is it better? Maybe. Is it good enough to base anything on? I don't think so still yet. So, I mean, if I'm 10% confident in my solution, that's better than being 5%.
Yeah.
Okay. That's not a whole lot of confidence. And I don't have like an R squared or anything for any particular method.
Yeah.
That's just, picking numbers out of a hat basically. So,
I'm just thinking from like a logical standpoint. So if the idea is on the defensive side, all of these sort of individual actions are connected to the defensive actions of the other four players on the floor. And it seems like that's the primary challenge for measuring defense, is that the individual actions that we can measure, even with things like sport view with closest defender distance and things like that, that those actions are connected to the actions of the other four players, then it seems like sort of that naturally implies that a top-down approach is sort of maybe the best way to capture everything. I'm totally playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying, and I'm reticent to buy in, just because, again, the not knowing the hows and whys of the top down kind of, okay, you can make an estimate that such and such a player was more impactful than another player of the given year, and where do you go from there? And in addition to the fact that there's just kind of a huge margin of error both ways on something like that.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we're there yet where that produces something that's necessarily something you can hang a hat on. I mean, it's, something like defensive RPM, it's as a data point, it's not useful. It should have been two knots. So it can be useful. But it's not, again, as I belabor, it's not rankings. It's not, it should not be taken as a ranking. And it's just one thing to take into account, and figuring out how that number is the kind of ways in which that number can be, distorted by team context and stuff like that.
And so you sort of spearheaded a lengthy discussion that we had at Nylon Calculus a few weeks ago about all-in-one metrics. And most of that focuses on plus minus, because I mean at this point, when people are talking about all-in-one metrics, they're just talking about sort of different plus minus variations. And it seemed like the group consensus, if I could frame it that way, was that that people generally felt like there was value in there, but that the caveat was that these metrics are maybe sometimes presented with a level of certainty that they don't warrant, that errors and confidence intervals are not always presented alongside them, and that they sort of, the nature of them unfortunately lends itself to misinterpretation as a ranking or as sort of a raw, as a raw measure of comparison. This player's RPM is this, so therefore they're, X much better than that player.
Yeah, I think that was the consensus. And on top of the measurable statistical error, I also think that there's sort of the additional kind of uncertainty of what we don't know about the kind of the input data. Even using just on off that's kind of the baseline dependent variable of the regression, basically, is we can visually see that some possessions are played at different intensity than others. Sometimes teams are experimenting, even if you filter out garbage time, so to speak, especially this time of the year, Teams are resting guys. Teams are running plays for different people than they might be. Like, you know, there's kind of an implicit assumption that everyone is always, you know, playing at maximal, you know, effort and intensity and stuff like that. And that's, you know, that's demonstrably untrue. And that's before we even get into things like, you know, guys playing with a nagging injury or, you know, fourth game in 5 nights or second game of a back to back on the road or versus a team that's, you know, or, you know, so I don't think that they're useless. And I think that I've perhaps come off as too strident against them. At times, but I wish there was more effort put into some more of the bottom up stuff. That a lot of really smart people are pouring a lot of brain power into kind of eking tiny percentage improvements out in these top down metrics, where there's just this vast realm of new, more granular individual data that we could be looking at to understanding, you know, other parts of the game better, and then maybe meeting in the middle as opposed to trying to go all the way down from the top.
Do you think that some of this, the state or whatever, where we are with these metrics is sort of like a product of the data that we've had, that, you know, play by play data was around for a while and it, that sort of the pool of useful bottom up data had been exhausted to some degree, and so what was left was trying to squeeze blood from a stone with plus minus, and now, you know, with what's available publicly from SportView, all of a sudden there's sort of a lot more bottom up information to incorporate.
No, I 100% agree with that, and that's you know, I think when I've written about this, I've recognized that, you know, okay, we got where we could get with, you know, box score regression and stuff like that. And so, like, the next place to go was, you know, the on-off stuff. But now we have just, you know, kind of the box score squared or cubed almost with you know, and probably more coming and other sources, you know, of information too. So there's just, you know, there's exponentially more of that kind of individual achievement on a finite level data that we can dig into, and I guess my frustration with the top down numbers is that I wish that the really smart people who spend a ton of time on that would spend more time going the other way, because you know the two of us are you know, kind of at the bleeding edge of our formal mathematic capabilities with some of the stuff we do, and we know people who have far more skills in that area than we do, and you know, but it seems to be that they're, you know, devoting time to building the perfect ridge regression of on-off data, which is, you know, which is neat, but it's also, how much better is it going to get?
So do you think, this is maybe a bigger picture analytic question, but it strikes me that there are competing markets for analytics, and that they are all jumbled together somewhat. You know, like, there are, what teams are looking for is very different than what the average Joe is looking for on ESPN, and you know, that a huge chunk of fans just want to know, is James Harden better than Stephen Curry this year? And they're looking for, you know, a sort of a simplistic way to answer that question. You know, whereas for, you know, at the team level in building a roster, that sort of question has no value or impact or importance at all.
And never gets, would never even be brought up.
Like, yeah.
The name the top 10 point guards go discussion. it just doesn't. Like, you know, it doesn't happen. I think I would need more than both hands to count the number of different of people from, like, different teams that I've heard some variation of of that. like no, we would never. We don't talk about that.
Yeah.
Like, who's got time for that nonsense?
So
and,
that,
you know, that's you know, it's the way they're consuming the game is different, and so it's not necessarily that the fan is wrong for wanting rankings, though it's not something that necessarily floats my boat. That's you know, that's an aesthetic judgment,
yeah,
rather than you know, it's something that everyone must abide by.
So then maybe some of this push and pull about analytics and one number metrics and things like that is the problem of people are looking for different things, and because it's analytics and it's still sort of to some degree niche, it's all lumped into the same pot, you know? Like, yeah. I mean, even we were talking about this before we started, but even at Nylon Calculus, you know, like we have some people on our staff who are sort of interested in media jobs, and so they approach analytics that way in sort of using analytics to tell stories and try and hook a larger audience. And then we have people on our staff who are interested in working for teams, and they approach analytics that way. And so we sort of have this, you know, we've gotten this criticism before, and it's totally fair that the content at Nylon Calculus is fairly uneven sometimes. And, you know, we were even talking about this around Sloan, that we had some people who were like, man, you got to do more narrative content. You know, like you guys kill that narrative stuff. We got to do more of that. And then, you know, turn around a few hours later and somebody be like, man, you guys got to do more like really, yeah. A few minutes later,
10 minutes.
Yeah. You guys got to do more of that, like really long, really in-depth research stuff, you know? And you know, when it comes to analytics, there's a demand coming from a lot of different areas, and it's sort of all getting served by the same spot. And so, you know, some people are always unhappy, I guess.
Yeah, and you're talking about that. I think that there is more of a, and maybe this is me, you know, hoping that wishing would make it so, mm-hmm. but I think that there is more of an appetite for kind of, bottom up nitty gritty analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Than is necessarily given credit for. I mean, I think there's always going to be a market for rankings. I mean, mm-hmm. there wouldn't be the constant stream of top 10x
mm-hmm.
if, you know, and, but even from the bottom up, I mean, you can, you know, I could certainly like write, you know, stuff based on kind of rim protection data about, you know, the top 10 rim protectors in the mm-hmm. NBA. And that's, and even that is, you know, that's certainly a more bottom up way of looking at things and, you know, a smaller level way to look at the game, not just like, is James Harden better than Steph Curry, which is, you know, kind of a meaningless question because, mm-hmm. you know, at least between guys at that level, like they're so close that, you know, how do you answer that question without looking at other factors?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you're talking about, you know, who else is on the Rockets? Who else is on the Warriors?
Yeah.
You know? And then are we really talking about Steph Curry and James Harden, or are we talking about, you know, them in the position that they're put?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so I don't know.
A little plug for Justin Willard. This podcast will run on Tuesday, and Justin wrote a great post at Nylon Calculus yesterday, Monday, basically looking at this exact same thing with Westbrook and Harden, and they're totally different, and they're both great, and really that's what's important, is that they're both great, even though they're totally different.
Yeah, and who knows who should be MVP.
Yeah, and we can stay away from that one.
Yeah. I've changed my mind like four times in the last 4 days about mm-hmm. if I had a ballot, who I would vote for. I think I've at a certain point each of the last 4 days, I've landed on each of Westbrook, Harden, Curry, and James.
Yeah,
and I don't know.
I probably threw my lot in a little early and went with Westbrook just. When it comes to things like that, I can divorce pretty strongly from the analytics, and just viscerally watching Westbrook just chew people up was it for me. But yeah, I don't know about now. But I did. So I want to move away from the general just a little bit and touch on one more thing. You wrote one piece about it, and it's something we've been talking a lot about in the thread and conversations with other people, is the idea of pace. And teams talk about pace all the time. Everybody wants to push the tempo. Pace has sort of been on the... has been sort of on people's minds, especially this year, because the Golden State Warriors... played a really fast pace the way it's typically measured, and that's something you would expect to see with a great offensive team, but the Warriors are also one of the best defensive teams in the league, and it's really, really rare to see a team play fast tempo and also be really good at defense, even on an efficiency standpoint. But you sort of were playing with the idea that there are two different kinds of pace, that there's offensive pace and defensive pace. And I should say you're not the only one. Adam Maris wrote about this yesterday, too, and a few other people as well.
And Mike Bowie, if I'm pronouncing mm-hmm. his written name correctly, at Inpredictable, yeah. has written some...
He's been on it this year, too.
Some very, very good stuff on that. I think that actually Mike at Inpredictable, he put this really well, in that, you know, one way to think about defense is kind of is a measure of denial. So if good defense is, making the other team turn down their first option. So if they're turning down their first option, that took time.
Yeah.
So now they're going to their second option. And if you defend that well, that's more time. And, mm-hmm. you know, every time you're making a team, you know, take the 3 to 5 seconds to get to their next little thing. Well, that's, you know, you do that, you know, 10 times in a game, you've just, you know, you've shaved 3 possessions off the game all of a mm-hmm. sudden. And so that's, you know, so playing good defense is in a way antithetical to pace, because to pace as measured in terms of just numbers of possessions, because, mm-hmm. you know, good defense means the other time is spending more time to find a good shot on offense, mm-hmm. With the caveat that good defense can also be, you know, forcing turnovers and stuff like that. But that's relatively minor, because, you know, turnovers don't end in turnovers, regardless of how bad Kentucky's offense is at the end of a national semifinal game, shall we say.
Can you explain briefly why do you think Golden State has been able to master this equation that other people haven't, where they are playing at a fast pace offensively and simultaneously playing slow defensively?
I think it's from the hip. It's they're so much faster offensively, mm-hmm. and big part of that is, you know, a problem that even teams that want to play at pace have is, when they get scored on, they walk the ball four. Mm-hmm. Golden State is still, I think when I looked at it, they were the only team that kind of got into their offense in under 10 seconds after made baskets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, getting into their offense is kind of a nebulous construct, but for, comparing apples to apples on whatever definition that the data I had was using, and I believe it was, the first time the ball crosses the 3-point arc,
mm-hmm.
They were the only team that took less than 10 seconds after the opponent made a shot to get something going.
Mm-hmm.
And, and that, so that's the kind of that dedication to, this thing that D'Antoni talked about at Sloan a little bit, was it's not sprinting up and down the court as much as it is, all right, let's get moving.
Yeah.
Just stay moving. And, if we do that every time, we'll get a fair amount of good open early looks. And I think that's a big part of what they're doing. And, mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt that, you have a guy who can dribble down and pull up from 27 feet and have that be a perfectly fine shot.
Yeah. And the defensive side is interesting, because so the Warriors play, they switch a lot, and the way their roster allows them to sort of cross match a lot and manage and survive on some of those possessions. Do you think that's something that since that's sort of allowing them to do this dichotomous pace, do you think that's something that sort of becomes more attractive to other teams around the league?
Well, the weird thing about that is, since they're playing, for so much of the small ball style, they're mm-hmm. they're pretty vulnerable on the to offensive rebounds. Mm-hmm. And you want to talk about something that kills pace of play in terms of number of possessions. It's mm-hmm. It's a trip where a team gets 3 or 4 shots,
mm-hmm.
and so that almost makes their ability to play so fast even more impressive. A lot of time, having the other team, relatively speaking, having the other team, kind of playing volleyball on the backboard a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and so that's kind of the downside to the small, versatile, switchy lineup,
mm-hmm.
is that you might give up some there. I think that this is something I think Chris Long wrote about this for our site, and had discussed it with a lot of people on Twitter is, mm-hmm. is it seems like Pace is about two-thirds the offense, one-third the defense.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, basically the offense has the speed they want to play, and sometimes the defense is able to alter that, and sometimes they aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of how it comes down to. So Pace is still, I guess, it's still primarily an offensive stat, but not completely, is I think, how I would come out on it.
It's funny because there's sort of this old, like, coaching conventional wisdom that if the other team's, you know, if the other team wants to play fast, then you sort of go out of your way to slow the pace down to sort of, you know, short circuit their preferred tempo. So you think that's a possibility too, watching the Warriors this year, that teams are sort of playing into that on the defensive side, that they're sort of, slowing down their own offensive pace in an effort to, you know, slow the game down?
Maybe that's one of those questions that if like, and trying to find analytic evidence of that is maybe tougher than mm-hmm. it is to find, look, you know, watching the game. Oh, well, this game's going to be a rock fight.
Yeah.
You can get that feel, you know, 3 minutes into a playoff game
mm-hmm.
versus a game where people are going up and down all the whole game. So, I don't know. That's an excellent question, I think, is whether or not that's the kind of thing that would get a team out of its own game or maybe force the Warriors to play at a tempo not of their choosing.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of matchup and style issues, I think, all play a big part in, you know, who has kind of edge in a playoff series.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that one of the things about the Warriors being so good with their small lineups is I think that, you know, they kind of force most teams to try to match those kind of lineups or else risk just getting run off the court. And mm-hmm. then, you know, regardless of where the game is being played, so it's almost a road game for the other team because they're, you know, playing the game where Golden State wants to with, mm-hmm. with the four small forwards on the court for each team, and then that's an environment that the Warriors are far more comfortable in than, you know, anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, advantage them. But maybe you feel like you have to do that because otherwise, okay, your two big guys are chasing their third and fourth small forwards and just not able to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about the Warriors more generally heading into the playoffs, it seems like they do some things that maybe don't fit with sort of like the popular perception of like what makes champions, you know, that they're, you know, that they rely heavily on jump shooting, that they play at a fast pace offensively, you know, they play small ball, maybe not great on the glass. It seems like they are not, it seems like heading into the playoffs, they are not as heavy favorites as they should be given how dominant they've been this regular season and how historic their point differential is. I mean, I haven't looked in the past couple of days, but for most of this season, it's pretty much been in the territory of you know, Jordan Bulls teams and nobody else.
It's like Jordan Bulls team, like the Lakers that won 33 in a row
mm-hmm.
is kind of the yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of that is we've never seen a team kind of like, you know, that is like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to the extent you want to compare them to the those Bulls teams, it's actually like stylistically not. I mean, those Bulls teams didn't necessarily play at a huge pace, but mm-hmm. in terms of kind of, you know, almost playing small ball and then and having some, you know, a lot of defensive versatility on the wings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's not the worst comparison, but the difference is, like, you know, Steph Curry isn't Michael Jordan. You know, yeah. Steph Curry isn't, like, we've never seen where the guy who is, like, and we have a guy who can just take over anytime. We haven't seen this kind of construct with that guy being, you know, a wispy jump shooter, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, reductive to Steph, obviously.
Yeah. But
still, you know, it, obviously there are certain things that like a Jordan or a LeBron can do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the Bulls' last title team, they won in large part because, you know, MJ is like, all right, I'm going to go in there and five guys are going to hit me really hard and then I'm going to make two free throws and then I'm going to do it again and then I'm going to do it again.
Yeah.
And you know, that's one of those things. Like, do the Warriors have that? Then again, is that is the kind of defense where, you know, that five person maul is going to happen? Is that something that is still like allowed in you know, modern playoff basketball? So I think the reticence, at least, and I've certainly been someone who's been, you know, slow to come around on the Warriors, like as in terms of all time greatness. And that's still kind of that's still the question I have is, you know, we haven't we, until we see it, we haven't seen it, and it's hard to totally credit it until we do, you know.
So heading into the playoffs, would they be your favorite? Would you, I mean, obviously I think I assume you'd take the field, but is there any, you know, if you had to pick a single team, is there anybody else you'd look favorably on above the Warriors?
I mean, I think it's the facile answer is to say the Cavs, just because they're, you know, they just seem have like they have an easier path to get there. I mean, if you want to say who like the, you know, in a vacuum the best team is, it's probably the Warriors. But in terms of, you know, those little bit of chances of them getting upset, you know, in maybe less so the first round series, but at least the second round series. I mean, are the Cavs really like are the Bulls as constituted really that much of a threat to the Cavs, especially as compared to who, you know, who's going to be the Warriors' second round matchup? It's going to be like the Clippers or the Rockets or the Grizzlies or something like that. Like, I don't know. I feel like those teams have a better chance against the Warriors than, you know, than the Bulls with or without, you know, this year's Derrick Rose have against Cleveland. But that's, you know, and then, you know, the Spurs are better than the Hawks when it comes to the playoffs and the conference finals too. So, you know, that's again, assuming that's the conference finals, is would be the Warriors and the Spurs. So, you know, the Spurs, let's put it this way, the Spurs are by a decent margin the toughest team either the Warriors or the Cavs would likely play on their road to the finals. So, you know, the Cavs probably the best chance of winning it all, just because, you know, getting there is, you know, half of winning the championship, right? So,
Other than just general playoff basketball, there are other things you're really excited to see, matchups you're looking forward to.
I think there's a lot of kind of basketball porn wrapped up in the like a Warriors Spurs series. I want to see, you know, like Kawhi guarding Steph, if that's going to be a thing that happens, or Danny Green guarding Steph, if that's a thing that happens, or even if they play Memphis, if Tony Allen guards them. I'm interested to see like what it would look like if a team was able to just put like a big dude on him for a series and see, you know, how that would he wear down? Would he be able to? Would he be as effective? Would he be? Would he just be too quick and run away from him and have to get out of it? That's something I'd be interested to see.
If you, I mean, if you could pick a dream matchup, would you still pick the Cavs, or would you rather watch the Hawks, match up with somebody from the West?
I mean, the first Hawks Warriors game was the best basketball game of the season. So, if they could play at that level, I would watch seven games of that super gladly. So, yeah.
Take as much of that as we can get.